the Arcanum, and it was a very small, very secret thing. They had a ranking system among themselves, and your rise through those ranks was due to prowess and nothing else. One entered this group by proving they could see things for what they really were. They became Elir, which means seer. How do you think they became Rela?
He looked at me expectantly.
By speaking.
He laughed.
Right.
He stopped and turned to face me.
But speaking what?
His eyes were bright and sharp.
Words? Names,
he said excitedly.
Names are the shape of the world, and a man who can speak them is on the road to power. Back in the beginning, the Arcanum was a small collection of men who understood things, men who knew powerful names. They taught a few students slowly, carefully encouraging them toward power and wisdom, and magic, real magic.
He looked around at the buildings and milling students.
In those days, the Arcanum was a strong brandy. Now it is well-watered wine.
I waited until I was sure he was finished.
Master Elodin, what happened yesterday?
I held my breath and hoped beyond hope for an intelligible answer. He gave me a quizzical look.
You called the name of De Wint?
He said, as if the answer were obvious.
But what does that mean? And what do you mean by name? Is it just a name like Quoth or Elodin, or is it more like Tarballin knew the names of many things?
Like both,
he said, waving to a pretty girl leaning out of a second-story window.
But how can a name do something like that? Quoth and Elodin are just sounds we make. They don't have any power by themselves.
Elodin raised his eyebrows at this.
Really?
Watch. He looked down the street.
Nathan!
He shouted. A boy turned to look in our direction. I recognized him as one of Jameson's errand boys.
Nathan, come here!
The boy trotted over and looked up at Elodin.
Yes, sir?
Elodin handed the boy his master's robe.
Nathan, would you take this to my rooms for me?
Certainly, sir.
The boy took the robe and hurried away. Elodin looked at me.
Do you see? The names we call each other are not names, but they have some power nonetheless.
That's not magic, I protested.
He had to listen to you. You're a master.
And you're a Rela,
he said implacably.
You called the wind, and the wind listened.
I struggled with the concept.
You're saying the wind is alive?
He made a vague gesture.
In a way, most things are alive in one way or another.
I decided to take a different tack.
How did I call the wind if I didn't know how?
Elodin clapped his hands together sharply.
That is an excellent question. The answer is that each of us has two minds, a waking mind and a sleeping mind. Our waking mind is what thinks and talks and reasons, but the sleeping mind is more powerful. It sees deeply to the heart of things. It is the part of us that dreams. It remembers everything. It gives us intuition. Your waking mind does not understand the nature of names. Your sleeping mind does. It already knows many things that your waking mind does not.
Elodin looked at me.
Remember how you felt after you called the name of the wind?
I nodded, not enjoying the memory.
When Ambrose broke your lute, it roused your sleeping mind like a great hibernating bear jabbed with a burning stick. It reared up and roared the name of the wind.
He swung his arms around wildly, attracting odd looks from passing students.
Afterwards, your waking mind did not know what to do. It was left with an angry bear.
What did you do? I can't remember what you whispered to me.
It was a name. It was a name that settled the angry bear, eased it back to sleep. But it is not sleeping so soundly now. We need to rouse it slowly and bring it under your control.
Is that why you moved to suspend my expulsion?
He made a dismissive gesture.
You are in no real danger of being expelled. You are not the first student to call the name of the wind in anger, though you are the first in several years. Some strong emotion usually wakes the sleeping mind for the first time.
He smiled.
The name of the wind came to me when I was arguing with Elk Sadal. When I shouted it, his braces exploded in a cloud of burning ash and cinder. He chuckled.
What did he do to make you so angry?
He refused to teach me the advanced bindings. I was only 14, and an Elia. He told me I would have to wait until I was a Raelar.
There are advanced bindings?
He grinned at me.
Secrets, Raelar Quoth. That is what being an Arcanist is all about. Now that you are a Raelar, you are entitled to certain things that were withheld before. The advanced sympathetic bindings, the nature of names, some smattering of dubious runes, if Kelvin thinks you're ready.
Hope rose in my chest.
Does this mean I'm allowed access to the archives now?
Ah, Elodin said. No, not in the least. You see, the archives are Lauren's domain, his kingdom. Those secrets are not mine to give away.
At his mention of secrets, my mind settled on one that had been bothering me for months. The secret at the heart of the archives.
What about the stone door in the archives?
I asked.
The four-plate door. Now that I'm a Raelar, can you tell me what's behind it?
Elodin laughed.
Oh, no. You don't aim for small secrets, do you?
He clapped me on the back as if I'd just made an especially good joke.
Alaritas. God. I can still remember what it was like standing down there looking at the door, wondering.
He laughed again.
Merciful Taylor, it almost killed me.
He shook his head.
No. You don't get to go behind the four-plate door, but,
he gave me a conspiratorial look,
since you are a Raelar.
He looked from side to side as if afraid that someone might overhear us. I leaned closer.
Since you are a Raelar, I will admit that it exists.
He gave me a solemn wink. Disappointed as I was, I couldn't help but smile. We walked for a while in silence, past mains, past anchors.
Master Elodin?
Yes?
His eyes followed a squirrel across the road and up a tree.
I still don't understand about names. I will teach you to understand,
he said easily.
The nature of names cannot be described, only experienced and understood. Why can't it be described?
I asked.
If you understand a thing, you can describe it. Can you describe all the things you understand?
He looked sideways at me.
Of course.
Elodin pointed down the street.
What color is that boy's shirt? Blue. What do you mean by blue? Describe it.
I struggled for a moment. Failed.
So blue is a name.
It is a word. Words are pale shadows of forgotten names. As names have power, words have power.
Words can light fires in the minds of men. Words can wring tears from the hardest hearts. There are 7 words that will make a person love you. There are 10 words that will break a strong man's will. But a word is nothing but a painting of a fire. A name is the fire itself.
My head was swimming by this point.
I still don't understand.
He laid a hand on my shoulder.
Using words to talk of words is like using a pencil to draw a picture of itself on itself. Impossible. Confusing. Frustrating.
He lifted his hands high above his head as if stretching for the sky.
But there are other ways to understanding!
He shouted, laughing like a child. He threw both arms to the cloudless arch of sky above us, still laughing.
Look!
He shouted, tilting his head back. Blue! 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 Chapter 87. A Heavy Question.
He's quite mad, I said to Simon and Willem later that afternoon at Anchor's.
He's a master, Sim responded tactfully. And your sponsor, and from what you've told us, he's the reason you weren't expelled.
I'm not saying that he isn't intelligent, and I've seen him do things that I can't begin to explain, but the fact remains that he is completely off his nut. He talks in circles about names and words and power. It sounds good while he's saying it, but it doesn't really mean anything.
Quit complaining, Simon said. You beat both of us to Raylar, even if your sponsor is cracked, and you got paid 2 span of silver for breaking Ambrose's arm. You got away free as a bird. I wish I had half your luck.
Not quite free as a bird, I said. I'm still going to be whipped.
What? Sim said. I thought you said they suspended it.
They suspended my expulsion, I said, not the whipping.
Simon gaped.
My God, why not?
Malfeasance, Willem said in a low voice. They can't let a student get off barred free after they've voted them guilty of malfeasance.
That's what Elodine said. I took a drink. Took another.
I don't care, Simon said hotly. It's barbaric.
He hammered out his last word on the table with his fist, upsetting his glass and spilling a dark pool of scutton across the table.
Shit!
He scrambled to his feet and tried to keep it from spilling on the floor with his hands. I laughed helplessly until there was water in my eyes and my stomach ached. I felt a weight lift off my chest as I finally regained my breath.
I love you, Sim, I said earnestly. Sometimes I think you're the only honest person I know.
He looked me over.
You're drunk. No, it's the truth. You're a good person.
Better than I'll ever be. He gave me a look that said he couldn't tell if he was being made fun of or not. A serving girl came over with wet rags, wiped the table clean, and made a few barbed comments. Sim had the decency to look embarrassed enough for all of us. By the time I made it back to the university, it was fully dark. I stopped briefly at Anchor's to pick up a few things, then made my way onto the roof of Maine's. I was surprised to find Auri waiting for me on the roof despite the clear sky. She sat on a short brick chimney, swinging her bare feet idly. Her hair made a gauzy cloud around her tiny form. She hopped down when I came closer and gave a little half-step sideways that was almost like a curtsy.
Good evening, Quoth.
Good evening, Auri, I said. How are you?
I'm lovely, she said firmly. And it is a lovely night.
She held both her hands behind her back and shifted from foot to foot. What have you brought me tonight? I asked. She gave her sunny smile.
What have you brought me?
I pulled a narrow bottle from underneath my cloak. I brought you some honey wine. She took hold of it with both hands.
Why, this is a princely gift.
She peered down at it wonderingly.
Think of all the tipsy bees.
She pulled the cork and sniffed it.
What's in it?
Sunlight, I said, and a smile and a question. She held the mouth of the bottle up to her ear and grinned at me. The question's at the bottom, I said.
A heavy question, she said,
then held her hand out to me.
I brought you a ring.
It was made of warm, smooth wood.
What does it do?
I asked.
It keeps secrets, she said.
I held it to my ear. Auri shook her head seriously, her hair swirling around her.
It doesn't tell them, it keeps them.
She stepped close to me and took the ring, sliding it onto my finger.
It's quite enough to have a secret, she chided me gently. Anything more would be greedy.
It fits, I said, somewhat surprised.
They're your secrets,
she said, as if explaining something to a child.
Who else would it fit?
Auri brushed her hair away behind her and made her curious half-step to the side again, almost like a curtsy, almost like a tiny dance.
I was wondering if you would join me for dinner tonight, Quoth,
she said, her face serious.
I have brought apples and eggs. I can also offer a lovely honey wine.
I'd love to share dinner with you, Auri, I said formally.
I have brought bread and cheese. Auri scampered down into the courtyard and in a few minutes returned with a delicate porcelain teacup for me. She poured the honey wine for both of us, drinking hers in a series of dainty sips from a silver beggar's cup hardly bigger than a thimble. I sat down on the roof, and we shared our meal. I had a large loaf of brown barley bread and a wedge of hard white Dalinea cheese. Auri had ripe apples and a half dozen brown spotted eggs that she had somehow managed to hard boil. We ate them with salt I brought out from a pocket in my cloak. We shared most of the meal in silence, simply enjoying each other's company. Auri sat cross-legged with her back straight and her hair fanning out to all sides. As always, her careful delicacy somehow made this makeshift meal on a rooftop seem like a formal dinner in some nobleman's hall.
"The wind has been bringing leaves into the underthing lately,"
Auri said conversationally toward the end of the meal.
"Through the grates and tunnels. They settle in the downings, so things are all a rustle there."
"Is that so?" She nodded.
"And a mother owl has moved in, made her nest right in the middle of the grade 12, bold as brass."
"She's something of a rarity, then?" She nodded.
"Absolutely. Owls are wise. They are careful and patient. Wisdom precludes boldness."
She sipped from her cup, holding the handle daintily between her thumb and forefinger.
"That is why owls make poor heroes."
"Wisdom precludes boldness. After my recent adventures in Trayborn, I couldn't help but agree. But this one is adventurous? An explorer?"
"Oh, yes,"
Auri said, her eyes wide.
"She is fearless. She has a face like a wicked moon."
She refilled her tiny silver cup with honey wine and emptied the last of it into my teacup. After tipping the bottle all the way upside down, she pursed her lips and blew across the top of it in two sharp bursts so that it made a hooting noise.
"Where's my question?"
she demanded. I hesitated, unsure as to how she would respond to my request. "I was wondering, Auri, would you mind showing me the underthing?" Auri looked away, suddenly shy.
"Quoth, I thought you were a gentleman,"
she said, tugging self-consciously at her ragged shirt.
"Imagine asking to see a girl's underthing."
She looked down, her hair hiding her face. I held my breath for a moment, choosing my next words carefully lest I startle her back underground. While I was thinking, Auri peeked at me through the curtain of her hair. "Auri?" I asked slowly. "Are you joking with me?" She looked up and grinned.
"Yes, I am,"
she said proudly.
"Isn't it wonderful?"
Auri took me through the heavy metal grate in the abandoned courtyard, down into the underthing. I brought out my hand lamp to light the way. Auri had a light of her own, something she held in her cupped hands that gave off a soft blue-green glow. I was curious about what she held, but didn't want to press her for too many secrets at once. At first, the underthing was exactly what I had expected. Tunnels and pipes, pipes for sewage, water, steam, and coal gas. Great black pig-iron pipes a man could crawl through, small, bright brass pipes no bigger around than your thumb. There was a vast network of stone tunnels branching and connecting at odd angles. If there were any rhyme or reason to the place, it was lost on me. Auri gave me a whirlwind tour, proud as a new mother, excited as a little girl. Her enthusiasm was infectious, and I soon lost myself in the excitement of the moment, ignoring my original reasons for wanting to explore the tunnels. There is nothing quite so delightfully mysterious as a secret in your own backyard. We made our way down three spiral staircases made of black wrought iron to reach the Grey 12. It was like standing in the bottom of a canyon. Looking up, I could see faint moonlight filtering in through drain grates far overhead. The mother owl was gone, but Auri showed me the nest. The deeper we went, the stranger things became. The round tunnels for drainage and pipes disappeared and were replaced with squared-off hallways and stairways strewn with rubble. Rotting wooden doors hung off rusted hinges, and there were half-collapsed rooms filled with mouldering tables and chairs. One room had a pair of bricked-up windows, despite the fact that we were, at my best guess, at least 50 feet below ground. Deeper still, we came to Through Bottom, a room like a cathedral so big that neither Aori's blue light nor my red one reached the highest peaks of the ceiling. All around us were huge, ancient machines. Some lay in pieces, broken gears taller than a man, leather straps gone brittle with age, great wooden beams that were now explosions of white fungus, huge as hedgerows. Other machines were intact, but worn by centuries of neglect. I approached an iron block as big as a farmer's cottage and broke off a single flake of rust large as a dinner plate. Underneath was nothing but more rust. Nearby there were three great pillars covered in green verdigris, so thick it looked like moss. Many of the huge machines were beyond identifying, looking more melted than rusted. But I saw something that might have been a water wheel, 3 stories tall, lying in a dry canal that ran like a chasm through the middle of the room. I had only the vaguest of ideas as to what any of the machines might have done. I had no guess at all as to why they had lain here for uncounted centuries, deep underground. There didn't seem. Chapter 88. Interlude. Looking. The sound of heavy boots on the wooden landing startled the men sitting in the Waystone Inn. Quoth bolted to his feet mid-sentence and was halfway to the bar before the front door opened and the first of the felling night crowd made their way inside.
"You've got hungry men here, Colt,"
Cobb called out as he opened the door. Shep, Jake and Graham followed him inside.
"We might have a little something in the back," Coach said. "I could run and fetch it straight away unless you'd like drinks first."
There was a chorus of friendly assent as the men settled onto their stools at the bar. The exchange had a well-worn feel, comfortable as old shoes. Chronicler stared at the red-haired man behind the bar. There was nothing left of Quoth in him. It was just an innkeeper, friendly, servile, and so unassuming as to almost be invisible. Jake took a long drink before noticing Chronicler sitting at the far end of the room.
"Well, look at you, Colt, a new customer. And we're lucky to have got any seats at all."
Shep chuckled. Cobb swiveled his stool around and peered at where Chronicler sat next to Bast, pen still poised over his paper.
"Is he a scribe or summat?"
"He is," Coach said quickly. "Came into town late last night."
Cobb squinted toward them.
"What's he writing?"
Coach lowered his voice a bit, drawing the attention of the customers away from the guest and back to his side of the bar.
"Remember that trip Bast made to Baden?" They nodded attentively. "Well, turns out he had a scare with the pox and he's been feeling his years a bit since then. He thought he'd best get his will writ down while he had the chance."
"Sense enough in that these days,"
Shep said darkly. He drank off the last of his beer and knocked the empty mug down.
"I'll do another of those.
Whatsoever monies I have saved at the time of my death shall go to the widow Sage,"
Bast said loudly across the room,
"to help in raising and dowering her 3 daughters, as they are soon to be of marriaging age."
He gave Chronicler a troubled look.
"Is marriaging a word?"
"Little Katie certainly has grown up a bit this last year, hasn't she?"
Graham mused. The others nodded in agreement.
"To my employer I leave my best pair of boots,"
Bast continued magnanimously,
"and whatsoever of my trousers he finds fit him."
"Boy does have a fine pair of boots," Cobb said to Coat. "Always thought so."
"I leave it to Pater Leoden to distribute the remainder of my worldly goods among the parish, as being an immoral soul I will have no further need of them."
"You mean immortal, don't you?"
Chronicler asked uncertainly.
Bast shrugged. "That's all I can think of for now.
Chronicler nodded and quickly shuffled the paper, pens and ink into his flat leather satchel.
"Come on over, then,"
Cobb called to him.
"Don't be a stranger."
Chronicler froze, then made his way slowly toward the bar.
"What's your name, boy?"
"Devon," he said, then looked stricken and cleared his throat. Carverson. Devon Carverson." Cobb made introductions all around, then turned back to the newcomer.
"Which way are you from, Devon?"
Cobb asked. "Off past Abbott's Ford."
"Any news from that way?"
Chronicler shifted uncomfortably in his seat, while Coate eyed him darkly from the other side of the bar.
"Well, the roads are rather bad."
This sparked a chorus of familiar complaints, and Chronicler relaxed. While they were still grousing, the door opened, and the smith's prentice came in, boyish and broad-shouldered, with the smell of coal smoke in his hair. A long rod of iron rested on his shoulder as he held the door open for Carter.
"You look a fool, boy,"
Carter groused as he made his way slowly through the door, walking with the stiff care of the recently injured.
"You keep hauling that around and folk will start talking about you like they do Crazy Martin. You'll be that crazy boy from Rhanish. You want to listen to that for the next 50 years?
The smith's prentice shifted his grip on the iron bar self-consciously.
"Let him talk," he mumbled with a hint of defiance. "Since I went out and took care of Nelly, I've been having dreams about that spider thing."
He shook his head.
"Hell, I'd think you'd be carrying one in each hand. That thing could have killed you."
Carter ignored him, his expression stiff as he walked gingerly toward the bar.
"Good to see you up and about, Carter,"
Shep called out, raising his mug.
"I thought we might not see you out of bed for another day or two." "Take more than a few stitches to keep me down,"
Carter said. Bast made a show of offering up his stool to the injured man, then quietly took a seat as far from the smith's prentice as possible. There was a warm murmur of welcome from everyone. The innkeeper ducked into the back room and emerged a few minutes later carrying a tray loaded with hot bread and steaming bowls of stew. Everyone was listening to Chronicler.
"If I remember right, Quoth was off in Severin when it happened. He was walking home."
"It weren't Severin,"
old Cobb said.
"It was off by the university."
"Could have been," Chronicler conceded. "Anyway, he was walking home late at night and some bandits jumped him in an alleyway."
"It was broad daylight,"
Cobb said testily.
"In the middle of town. All manner of folk were around to see it."
Chronicler shook his head stubbornly.
"I remember an alley. Anyway, the bandits surprised Quoth. They wanted his horse."
He paused and rubbed his forehead with the tips of his fingers.
"Wait, that's not right. He wouldn't have his horse in an alley. Maybe he was on the road to Severin."
"I told you it weren't Severin,"
Cobb demanded, slapping his hand down on the bar, plainly irritated.
"Taylor, anyway, just stop. You've got it all mixed up."
Chronicler flushed in embarrassment.
"I only heard it once, years ago."
Shooting Chronicler a dark look, Coate clattered the tray down loudly onto the bar, and the story was momentarily forgotten. Old Cobb ate so quickly, he almost choked himself and washed it down with a long swallow of beer.
"Seeing as how you're still working on your dinner there,"
he said none too casually to Chronicler as he wiped his mouth on his sleeve.
"Would you mind terribly if I picked up the story, just so's the boy can hear it?"
"If you're sure you know it,"
Chronicler said hesitantly.
"Of course I know it,"
Cobb said as he spun his stool around to face more of his audience.
"All right. Way back when Quoth was just a pup, he went to the university. But he didn't live in the university proper, you see, on account of the fact that he was just ordinary folk. He couldn't afford all the fancy living that went on there."
"How come?"
the smith's prentice asked.
"You said before that Quoth was so smart, they paid him to stay even though he was just 10 years old. They gave him a purse full of gold and a diamond big as his thumb knuckle, and a brand new horse with a new saddle and tack and new shoes and a full bag of oats and everything."
Cobb gave a conciliatory nod.
"True, that's true, but this was a year or two after Quoth had got all that. And you see, he'd gave a lot of that gold to some poor folk whose houses had all burned down."
"Burned down during their wedding,"
Graham interjected. Cobb nodded.
"And Quoth had to eat and rent a room, and by more oats for his horse, so his gold was all used up by then. So he...
What about the diamond?
The boy insisted. Old Cobb gave the barest of frowns.
If you've got to know, he gave that diamond to a special friend of his. A special lady friend. But that's a whole different story than the one I'm telling now.
He glared at the boy, who dropped his eyes contritely and spooned up a mouthful of stew. Cobb continued.
Since Quoth couldn't afford all that rich living in the university, he stayed in the town next by instead, place called Amory.
He shot Chronicler a pointed look.
Quoth had a room in an inn, where he got to stay there for free because the widow who owned the place took a shine to him, and he did chores to help earn his keep.
He played music there too,
Jake added.
He was all sorts of clever with his lute.
Get your dinner into your gob and let me finish my say, Jacob,
old Cobb snapped.
Everyone knows Quoth was clever with a lute. That's why the widow had taken such a shine to him in the first place, and playing music every night was part of his chores.
Cobb took a quick drink and continued.
So, one day, Quoth was out running errands for the widow, when a fella pulls out a knife and tells Quoth if he doesn't hand over the widow's money, he'll spill Quoth's guts all over the street.
Cobb pointed an imaginary knife at the boy and gave him a menacing look.
Now you've got to remember, this is back when Quoth was just a pup. He ain't got no sword, and even if he did, he ain't learned to fight proper from the Adam yet.
So what did Quoth do?
The smith's apprentice asked.
Well...
Cobb leaned back.
It was the middle of the day, and they were smack in the middle of Amory's town square. Quoth was about to call for the constable, but he always had his eyes wide open, you see, and so he noticed that this fellow had white, white teeth.
The boy's eyes grew wide.
He was a sweet eater,
Cobb nodded.
And even worse, the fellow was starting to sweat like a hard-run horse. His eyes were wild, and his hands...
Cobb widened his own eyes and held out his hands, making them tremble.
So Quoth knew the fella had the hunger something fierce, and that meant he'd stab his own mum for a bent penny.
Cobb took another long drink, drawing out the tension.
Whatever did he do?
Bast burst out anxiously from the far end of the bar, wringing his hands dramatically. The innkeeper glared at his student. Cobb continued.
Well... First, he hesitates, and the man comes closer with the knife, and Quoth can see the fella ain't going to ask again. So, Quoth uses a dark magic that he found locked away in a secret book at the university. He speaks three terrible secret words and calls up a demon.
A demon?
The prentice's voice was almost a yelp.
Was it like the one?
Cobb shook his head slowly.
Oh, no. This one weren't spiderly at all. It was worse. This one was made all of shadows, and when it landed on the fella, it bit him on the chest right over his heart, and it drank all the blood out of him like you'd suck the juice out of a plum.
Blackened hands, Cobb, Carter said, his voice thick with reproach. You're going to give the boy nightmares. He'll be carrying around that damn iron stick for a year with all your nonsense stuffed in his head.
That's not how I heard it,
Graham said slowly.
I heard there was a woman trapped in a burning house, and Quoth called up a demon to protect him from the fire. Then he ran inside and pulled the lady out of the fire, and she wasn't burned at all.
Listen to yourselves, Jake said, disgusted. You're like kids at midwinter. Demons stole my doll. Demons build the milk. Quoth didn't meddle with demons. He was at the university learning all manner of names, right? The fellow came at him with a knife, and he called out, "Fire and lightning, just like Taborlin the Great."
"It was a demon, Jake,"
Cobb said angrily.
"Otherwise the story don't make a lick of sense. It was a demon he called up, and it drank up the fella's blood, and everyone who saw was powerful sugar by it. Someone told a priest, then the priest went to the constable, and the constable went and pulled him out of the widow's inn that night. Then they slapped him in a jail. For consorting with dark forces and such.
Folk probably just saw the fire and thought it was a demon, Jake persisted. You know how folk are.
No, I don't, Jacob,
Cobb snapped, crossing his arms in front of his chest and leaning back against the bar.
Why don't you tell me how folk are? Why don't you just go ahead and tell this whole damn story? Well,
Cobb stopped at the sound of heavy boots clumping on the wooden landing outside. After a pause, someone fumbled with the latch. Everyone turned around to look at the door, curious, as all the regular customers were already there.
Two new faces in one day,
Graham said gently, knowing he was touching on a delicate subject.
Looks like your dry spell might be over, Coat.
Rose must be getting better,
Shep said into his drink, a hint of relief in his voice.
About time we got a touch of luck.
The latch clicked, and the door swung slowly open, moving in a slow arc until it struck the wall. A man stood outside in the dark, as if deciding whether or not to come in.
Welcome to the Waystone,
the innkeeper called out from behind the bar.
What can we do for you?
The man stepped into the light, and the farmer's excitement was smothered by the sight of the piecemeal leather armor and heavy sword that marked a mercenary. A lone mercenary was never reassuring, even in the best of times. Everyone knew that the difference between an unemployed mercenary and a highwayman was mostly one of timing. What's more, it was obvious this mercenary had fallen on hard times. Brown Burr clung thick to the bottoms of his trousers and the rough leather of his boots' laces. His shirt was fine linen dyed a deep royal blue but mud-spattered and bramble-torn. His hair was a greasy snarl. His eyes were dark and sunken, as if he hadn't slept in days. He moved a few steps farther into the inn, leaving the door open behind him.
Looks like you've been on the road a while, Quoth said cheerily. Would you like a drink or some dinner?
When the mercenary made no reply, he added,
None of us would blame you if you wanted to catch a bit of sleep first, either. It looks like you've had a rough couple of days.
Quoth glanced at Bath, who slid off his stool and went to close the inn's front door. After slowly looking over everyone sitting at the bar, the mercenary moved to the empty space between Chronicler and Old Cobb. Quoth gave his best innkeeper smile as the mercenary leaned heavily against the bar and mumbled something. Across the room, Bast froze, with his hand on the door handle.
Beg your pardon?
Quoth asked, leaning forward.
The mercenary looked up, his eyes meeting Quoth's, then sweeping back and forth behind the bar.
His eyes moved sluggishly, as if he had been addled by a blow to the head.
I think sick this story staving thee.
Quoth leaned forward. I'm sorry, what was that again? When nothing was forthcoming from the mercenary, he looked around at the other men at the bar.
Did anyone catch that?
Chronicler was looking the mercenary over, eyeing the man's armor, the empty quiver of arrows, his fine blue linen shirt. The scribe's stare was intense, but the mercenary didn't seem to notice.
It's the arrow,
Cobb said knowingly.
Funny, you don't look like a shimp.
Shep laughed, shaking his head.
Nah, he's drunk. My uncle used to talk like that.
He nudged Graham with an elbow.
You remember my Uncle Tam? God, I've never known a man who drank like that.
Bast made a frantic, covert gesture from where he stood near the door, but Quoth was busy trying to catch the mercenary's eye.
Speak, Aturin,
Quoth asked slowly.
What do you want?
The mercenary's eyes rested momentarily on the innkeeper.
Avoy,
he began, then closed his eyes and tilted his head as if listening. He opened his eyes again.
I want,
he began, his voice slow and thick.
I look,
he trailed off, his gaze wandering aimlessly around the room, his eyes unfocused.
I know him,
Chronicler said. Everyone turned to look at the scribe.
What?
Shep asked. Chronicler's expression was angry.
This fellow and four of his friends robbed me about 5 days ago. I didn't recognize him at first. He was clean-shaven then, but it's him.
Behind the man's back, Bast made a more urgent gesture, trying to catch his master's attention, but Quoth was intent on the befuddled man.
Are you sure?
chronicler gave a hard, humorless laugh.
He's wearing my shirt. Ruined it, too. Cost me a whole talent. I never even got a chance to wear it.
Was he like this before? Chronicler shook his head.
Not at all. He was almost genteel, as highwaymen go. I had him pegged as a low-ranking officer before he deserted.
Bast gave up signalling.
Reshi,
he called out, a hint of desperation in his voice.
Just a moment, Bast,
Quoth said as he tried to catch the stupefied mercenary's attention. He waved a hand in front of the man's face, snapped his fingers. Hello? The man's eyes followed Quoth's moving hand, but seemed oblivious to everything being said around him.
I am Hook,
he said slowly.
I look.
What? Quoth demanded testily. What are you looking for?
Looking.
The mercenary echoed vaguely.
I imagine he's looking to give me my horse back, Chronicler said calmly as he took a half step closer to the man and grabbed the hilt of his sword.
With a sudden motion, he yanked it free, or rather he tried to. Instead of sliding easily free of its scabbard, it came halfway out and stuck.
No!
Bast cried from across the room. The mercenary stared vaguely at Chronicler but made no attempt to stop him. Standing awkwardly, still gripping the hilt of the man's sword, the scribe tugged harder and the sword pulled slowly free. The broad blade was mottled with dried blood and rust. Taking a step back, Chronicler regained his composure and leveled the sword at the mercenary.
And my horse is just for starters. Afterwards, I think he's looking to give me my money back and have a nice chat with the constable.
The mercenary looked at the point of the sword where it swayed unsteadily in front of his chest. His eyes followed the gently swaying motion for a long moment.
Just leave him be,
Bast's voice was shrill.
Please!
Cobb nodded.
Boy's right, Devon. Fella's not right in his head. Don't go pointing that at him. He looks likely to pass out on top of it.
The mercenary absent-mindedly lifted a hand.
I am looking,
he said, brushing the sword aside as if it were a branch blocking his path. Chronicler sucked in a breath and jerked the sword away as the man's hand ran along the edge of the blade, drawing blood.
See, old Cobb said, what I tell you, sod's a danger to himself.
The mercenary's head tilted to the side. He held up his hand, examining it. A slow trickle of dark blood made its way down his thumb, where it gathered and swelled for a moment before dripping onto the floor. The mercenary drew a deep breath through his nose, and his glassy, sunken eyes came into sudden, sharp focus. He smiled wide at Chronicler, all the vagueness gone from his expression.
Devarain arwa, stethalohi vehimela.
He said in a deep voice.
I don't follow you,
Chronicler said, disconcerted. The man's smile fell away, his eyes hardened, grew angry.
Te tauren, skriloe, amawen.
I can't tell what you're saying, Chronicler said, but I don't care for your tone.
He brought the sword back up between them, pointing at the man's chest. The mercenary looked down at the heavy, notched blade, his forehead furrowing in confusion. Then sudden understanding spread across his face, and the wide smile returned. He threw back his head and laughed. It was no human sound, it was wild and exulting like a hawk's shrill cry. The mercenary brought up his injured hand and grabbed the tip of the sword, moving with such sudden speed that the metal rang dully with the contact. Still smiling, he tightened his grip, bowing the blade. Blood ran from his hand down the sword's edge to patter onto the floor. Everyone in the room watched in stunned disbelief. The only sound was the faint grating of the mercenary's finger bones grinding against the bare edges of the blade. Looking Chronicler full in the face, the mercenary twisted his hand sharply and the sword broke with a sound like a shattered bell. As Chronicler stared dumbly at the ruined weapon, the mercenary took a step forward and laid his empty hand lightly on the scribe's shoulder.
Chronicler gave a choked scream and jerked away as if he had been jabbed with a hot poker. He swung the broken sword wildly, knocking the hand away and notching it deep into the meat of the mercenary's arm. The man's face showed no pain or fear or any sign of awareness that he'd been wounded at all. Still holding the broken tip of the sword in his bloody hand, the mercenary took another step toward Chronicler. Then Bast was there, barreling into the mercenary with one shoulder, striking him with such force that the man's body shattered one of the heavy barstools before slamming into the mahogany bar. Quick as a blink, Bast grabbed the mercenary's head with both hands and slammed it into the edge of the bar. Lips pulled back in a grimace, Bast drove the man's head viciously into the mahogany, once, twice. Then, as if Bast's action had startled everyone awake, chaos erupted in the room. Old Cobb pushed himself away from the bar, tipping his stool over as he backed away. Graham began shouting something about the constable. Jake tried to bolt for the door and tripped over Cobb's fallen stool, sprawling to the floor in a tangle. The smith's prentice grabbed for his iron rod and ended up knocking it to the floor, where it rolled in a wide arc and came to rest under a table. Bast gave a startled yelp and was thrown violently across the room to land on one of the heavy timber tables. It broke under his weight, and he lay sprawled in the wreckage, limp as a rag doll. The mercenary came to his feet, blood flowing freely down the left-hand side of his face. He seemed utterly unconcerned as he turned back to Chronicler, still holding the tip of the broken sword in his bleeding hand. Behind him, Shep picked up a knife from where it lay next to the half-eaten wheel of cheese. It was just a kitchen knife, its blade about a handspan long. Face grim, the farmer stepped close behind the mercenary and stabbed down hard, driving the whole of the short blade deep into the mercenary's body where the shoulder meets the neck. Instead of collapsing, the mercenary spun around and lashed Shep across the face with the jagged edge of the sword. Blood sprayed, and Shep lifted his hands to his face. Then, moving so quickly it was little more than a twitch, the mercenary brought the piece of metal back around, burying it in the farmer's chest. Shep staggered backward against the bar, then collapsed to the floor with the broken end of the sword still jutting between his ribs. The mercenary reached up and curiously touched the handle of the knife lodged in his own neck. His expression more puzzled than angry, he tugged at it. When it didn't budge, he gave another wild, bird-like laugh. As the farmer lay gasping and bleeding on the floor, the mercenary's attention seemed to wander, as if he had forgotten what he was doing. His eyes slowly wandered around the room, moving lazily past the broken tables, the black stone fireplace, the huge oak barrels. Finally, the mercenary's gaze came to rest on the red-haired man behind the bar. Quoth did not blanch or back away when the man's attention settled onto him. Their eyes met. The mercenary's eyes sharpened again, focusing on Quoth. The wide, humorless smile reappeared, made macabre by the blood running down his face.
Teyatien, said Alawal, he demanded. Terintail.
With an almost casual motion, Quoth grabbed a dark bottle from the counter and flung it across the bar. It struck the mercenary in the mouth and shattered, the air filled with the sharp tang of elderberry dousing the man's still grinning head and shoulders. Reaching out one hand, Quoth dipped a finger into the liquor that spattered the bar. He muttered something under his breath, his forehead furrowed in concentration. He stared intently at the bloody man standing on the other side of the bar. Nothing happened. The mercenary reached across the bar, catching hold of Quoth's sleeve. The innkeeper simply stood, and in that moment his expression held no fear, no anger or surprise. He only seemed weary, numb, and dismayed. Before the mercenary could get a grip on Quoth's arm, he staggered as Bast tackled him from behind. Bast managed to get one arm around the mercenary's neck while the other raked at the man's face. The mercenary let go of Quoth and laid both hands on the arm that circled his neck, trying to twist away. When the mercenary's hands touched him, Bast's face became a tight mask of pain. Teeth bared, he clawed wildly at the mercenary's eyes with his free hand. At the far end of the bar, the smith's prentice finally retrieved his iron rod from under the table and stretched to his full height. He charged over the fallen stools and strewn bodies on the floor. Bellowing, he lifted the iron rod high over one shoulder. still clinging to the mercenary, Bast's eyes grew wide with sudden panic as he saw the smith's prentice approaching. He released his grip and backed away, his feet tangling in the wreckage of the broken barstool. Falling backward, he scuttled madly away from the both of them. Turning, the mercenary saw the tall boy charging. He smiled and stretched out a bloody hand. The motion was graceful, almost lazy. The smith's prentice swatted the arm away. When the iron bar struck him, the mercenary smile fell away. He clutched at his arm, hissing and spitting like an angry cat. The boy swung the iron rod again, striking the mercenary squarely in the ribs. The force of it knocked him from the bar, and he fell to his hands and knees, screaming like a slaughtered lamb. The smith's prentice grabbed the bar with both hands and brought it down across the mercenary's back like a man splitting wood. There was the grisly sound of bones cracking. The iron bar rang softly like a distant fog-muffled bell. Back broken, the bloody man still tried to crawl toward the inn's door. His face was blank now, his mouth open in a low howl, as constant and unthinking as the sound of wind through winter trees. The prentice struck again and again, swinging the heavy iron rod lightly as a willow switch. He scored a deep groove in the wooden floor, then broke a leg, an arm, more ribs. Still, the mercenary continued to claw his way toward the door, shrieking and moaning, sounding more animal than human. Finally, the boy landed a blow to the head, and the mercenary went limp. There was a moment of perfect quiet. Then the mercenary made a deep, wet, coughing sound, and vomited up a foul liquid, thick as pitch and black as ink. It was some time before the boy stopped battering at the motionless corpse, and even when he did stop, he held the bar poised over one shoulder, panting raggedly and looking around wildly. As he slowly caught his breath, the sound of low prayers could be heard from the other side of the room, where old Cobb crouched against the black stone of the fireplace. After a few minutes, even the praying stopped, and silence returned to the Waystone Inn. For the next several hours, the Waystone was the center of the town's attention. The common room was crowded, full of whispers, murmured questions, and broken sobbing. Folk, with less curiosity or more propriety, stayed outside, peering through the wide windows and gossiping over what they'd heard. There were no stories yet, just a roiling mass of rumor. The dead man was a bandit come to rob the inn. He'd come looking for revenge against Chronicler, who deflowered his sister off in Abbot's Ford. He was a woodsman gone rabid. He was an old acquaintance of the innkeeper come to collect a debt. He was an ex-soldier gone tabard mad while fighting the rebels off in Resavec. Jake and Carter made a point of the mercenary smile, and while Denner addiction was a city problem, folk had still heard of sweet eaters here. Three-finger Tom knew about these things as he'd soldiered under the old king nearly 30 years ago. He explained that with 4 grains of Denner resin, a man could have his foot amputated without a twinge of pain. With 8 grains, he'd saw through the bone himself. With 12 grains, he'd go for a jog afterward, laughing and singing Tinker Tanner. Shep's body was covered with a blanket and prayed over by the priest. Later, the constable looked at it as well, but the man was clearly out of his depth and was looking because he felt he should rather than because he knew what to look for. The crowd began to thin after an hour or so. Shep's brothers showed up with a cart to collect the body. Their grim, red-eyed stares drove away most of the remaining spectators who were idling about. Still, there was much to be done. The constable tried to piece together what had happened from witnesses and the more opinionated onlookers. After hours of speculation, the story finally began to coalesce. Eventually, it was agreed that the man was a deserter and Denner addict come to their little town just in time to go crazy. It was clear to everyone that the smith's prentice had done the right thing, a brave thing in fact. Still, the iron law demanded a trial, so there'd be one next month, when the quarter court came through these parts on its rounds. The constable went home to his wife and children. The priest took the mercenary's remains off to the church. Bast cleared the wrecked furniture away, stacking it near the kitchen door to be used as firewood. The innkeeper mopped the inn's hardwood floor 7 times, until the water in the bucket no longer tinged red when he rinsed it out. Eventually, even the most dedicated gawkers drifted away, leaving the usual Felling Night crowd, -1. Jake, Cobb, and the rest made halting conversation, speaking of everything other than what had happened, clinging to the comfort of each other's company. One by one, exhaustion drove them out of the waystone. Eventually, only the smith's prentice remained, looking down into the cup in his hands. The iron rod lay near his elbow on the top of the mahogany bar. Nearly 30 minutes passed without anyone speaking. Chronicler sat at a nearby table making a pretense of finishing a bowl of stew. Quoth and Bast puttered about, trying to look busy. A vague tension built in the room as they snuck glances at each other, waiting for the boy to leave. The innkeeper strolled over to the boy, wiping his hands on a clean linen cloth.
Well, boy, I guess...
Aaron, the smith's prentice interjected, not looking up from his drink.
My name's Aaron.
Quoth nodded seriously.
Aaron, then. I suppose you deserve that.
I don't think it was Denner,
Aaron said abruptly. Quoth paused.
Beg pardon?
I don't think that fellow was a sweet eater.
You with Cobb, then? Quoth asked. Think he was rabid?
I think he had a demon in him,
the boy said with careful deliberation, as if he'd been thinking about the words for a long time.
I didn't say anything before, because I didn't want folk to think I'd gone all cracked in the head like Crazy Martin.
He looked up from his drink.
But I still think he had a demon in him.
Quoth put on a gentle smile and gestured to Bast and Chronicler.
Aren't you worried we'll think the same?
Aaron shook his head seriously.
You aren't from around here. You've been places. You know what sort of things are out in the world.
He gave Quoth a flat look.
I figure you know it was a demon too.
Bast grew still where he stood, sweeping near the hearth. Quoth tilted his head curiously without looking away.
Why would you say that?
The smith's prentice gestured behind the bar.
I know you got a big oak drunk thumper under the bar there. And, well,
his eyes flickered upward to the sword hanging menacingly behind the bar.
There's only one reason I can think you'd grab a bottle. Instead of that, you weren't trying to knock that fellow's teeth in. You were going to light him on fire. Except you didn't have any matches. And there weren't any candles close by. My ma used to read to me from the Book of the Path, he continued. There's plenty of demons in there. Some hide in men's bodies like we'd hide under a sheepskin. I think he was just some regular fella who'd got a demon inside him. That's why nothing hurt him. It'd be like someone poking holes in your shirt. That's why he didn't make no sense either. He was talking demon talk.
Aaron's eyes slid back to the cup he held in his hands, nodding to himself.
The more I think, the better it makes sense. Iron and fire. That's for demons.
Sweet eaters are stronger than you'd think,
Bast said from across the room.
Once I saw...
You're right, Quoth said. It was a demon.
Aaron looked up to meet Quoth's eye, then nodded and looked down into his mug again.
And you didn't say anything because you're new in town, and business is shy enough.
Quoth nodded.
And it won't do me any good to tell folk, will it?
Quoth drew a deep breath, then let it out slow.
Probably not.
Aaron drank off the last swallow of his beer and pushed the empty mug away from himself on the bar.
All right. I just needed to hear it. Needed to know I hadn't gone all crazy.
He came to his feet and picked up the heavy iron rod with one hand resting it on his shoulder as he turned toward the door. No one spoke as he made his way across the room and let himself out, closing the door behind him. His heavy boots sounded hollowly on the wooden landing outside. Then there was nothing.
There's more to that one than I would have guessed, Quoth said at last.
It's because he